Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. My guest today is historian Dr. Liam O'Callaghan. Liam works at Liverpool Hope University and is the author of Rugby in Munster, A Social and Cultural History, which is simply the best account of Irish rugby that's so far been published. He's also written many other articles on the history of the game in Ireland, and his most recent work looks at the history of the relationship between Protestants and Catholics in Irish rugby union. So, welcome to the podcast, Liam.
Thanks, Tony.
To start with, can you just outline the origins of rugby in Ireland and how it developed into a game that spread across the entire island?
Well, it arrived first at Trinity College Dublin in the 1850s. The precise moment at which it arrived and who brought it is a bit obscure. But we do know that there was a football club there from the mid-1850s, and we do know that a lot of its membership was made up of ex-rugby schoolboys, essentially. Matters became a bit more formalised from the 1860s when an ex-rugby boy called Charles Barrington, a Limerick man, came back from rugby and enrolled at Trinity and claims to have introduced the first rule book at Trinity at that particular point. Now, so he claims to have formalised it. Meanwhile, up north in Belfast, a completely separate development was the founding of the North of Ireland Football Club. Again, there was ex-rugby, ex-Cheltenham boys involved in that. So essentially, in its origins, it was a game that was imported. How it spread is a little bit obscure. We don't really know precisely, but we do know that from the late 1860s, there was a football club at Cork. Don't know exactly how it originated. There was a football club just outside Cork at Middleton College. And from the early 1870s, there was a football club at Limerick. Now, this was the initiative of Barrington again. So he essentially brought the game south from Dublin University down to Limerick. The game also expanded in Belfast, and eventually clubs started cropping up in around Dublin and Belfast with more regularity. And a similar thing happened in Cork and Limerick. So essentially by the end of the 1870s, there was kind of two main centres, Dublin and Belfast, with kind of other areas of strength in Cork and Limerick. First administrative body was set up in 1874. That was the Irish Football Union. That was a Dublin-based body. And a separate governing body was set up in Belfast. They called themselves the Northern Union or the Northern Football Union. And they eventually merged in 1879 to become the Irish Rugby Football Union. Now, the reasons they stayed apart for those 5 years are unclear as well. Some people have tried to ascribe some sort of political significance to it. I don't think there is. I think you don't have to go far beyond the realms of the psychology of young men to figure out that one group set up a body, a separate group set up another body, and they were too stubborn to merge initially, and eventually they did. And from 1879 onwards, then you had an Irish Rugby Football Union with provincial branches in Ulster, Leinster and Munster. And eventually, in 1885, there was a provincial branch in Connacht. And that was the structure that the professional game was eventually grafted onto in the late 1990s.
One of the obvious things that everybody knows about Ireland is that obviously deep divisions along religious/political lines. How did rugby in the early years transcend that? Because it doesn't appear that that becomes an issue in the 19th century.
It didn't need to transcend it, because if you look at Dublin and Belfast and the men who ran the game and who played it, they were from the same demographic. They were Protestant and they were Unionist. So essentially, and they were middle class and upper middle class. So essentially, they were the same people. I mean, from the late 1870s going into the 1880s, Ulster began to be imagined as a place apart because of nationalist politics in Ireland. But by and large, these men had a lot in common. So the game was very uniform in its demographic profile. And you could say the same for Limerick and Cork down to the 1880s as well. So Catholics only began to appear in the corridors of power of Irish rugby much later. So there wasn't any real friction to transcend at that point.
What about spreading through classes? Because obviously, as you've written about in Munster, rugby there became a cross-class game and kind of escaped the concentration in the middle classes and embraced all classes in society. How did that happen?
Well, I think it's a product of a few things. First and foremost, as you know from studying rugby league, if you look at a town of a certain size, it has a different sort of a civic culture than big cities have. So it's very easy for a relatively small number of people, business people and professionals, to become what we might term local notables and people who have sort of a civic significance, public men, as it were. And in the context of 19th century associational culture, sport clubs become an awful lot more important. So in Limerick, for example, Gary Owen Football Club, which was the main rugby club well into the 20th century, was set up in 1884. And it was basically a joint project between Catholic and Protestant elites in the city. And at that time as well, a culture of inter-parish junior rugby emerged, and it was played on Sundays. And Sunday was obviously the only available day to play rugby for the working classes. And instead of shunning this culture of Sunday rugby, I mean, the IRFU was dead set against any play on Sundays, Gary Owen Rugby Club actually embraced it and acted as a sort of a proxy administrative body for the tournaments that the junior clubs played. And key Catholic and Protestant figures in Limerick embraced the junior game. And as a result of that, the game took root. It became popular. And Gary Owen became essentially a representative team because they instrumentalized the junior game by using it as a recruiting ground for their senior team. So a durable structure emerged, and inter-parish rivalries were intense. And the game essentially became associated with the city as a result of that. You have to remember, Limerick, even though it's a city, is a population of only around 35,000 in 1901. So in the British scheme of things, it's not even a medium-sized town, you know? So it's very easy for public-facing men to take on a certain profile and to use sports clubs as a way of cementing their profile within the city and to fulfill their whatever altruistic instincts they may have, you know, the idea that we should give back something to the city.
The other thing I think is it makes Ireland different from pretty much all other places where rugby becomes a dominating sport is obviously that it has the competition from the Gaelic Athletic Association, which prides itself on its nationalism and its support for Irish traditions and, you know, presents rugby, at least in its press, as an alien game. How did rugby cope with the growth of the GAA in the late 19th century, early 20th century? Did the GAA diminish or deplete rugby in terms of its popularity or its players?
I think it definitely inhibited its potential growth and its potential expansion, especially into rural areas. But I think, having said that, there's an extent to which they weren't actually competing with each other at all, because rugby was primarily an urban game and sporting tastes in urban Ireland were and remain more eclectic than they do in the countryside. So the GAA's main constituency always was the rural parish, to the extent that one of the GAA's main aims was to implant itself in every parish, every Catholic parish in the country, and to have a club in each parish. So there's a degree to which they weren't actually competing with each other at all. Where they might have competed with each other would have been in Limerick. But by the time the GAA actually arrives in Limerick in any meaningful way in the late 1880s, and we have to remember the GAA, after an encouraging start, declined quite rapidly in the context of political instability. By the time that they started to take root in Limerick, it was already too late. Rugby had already taken root and people were reluctant to give up the game that they preferred at that point. If you look at Dublin, into the 1880s, the game in Dublin was mainly played by Protestants anyway, and they weren't going to be playing Gaelic games. In Ulster, rugby was uniformly Protestant and unionist and openly hostile to Gaelic games. So if you look at it on a region-by-region basis, to a large degree, they weren't competing with each other at all. But I do think, to look at it counterfactually, if the GAA had never been founded, rugby may well have become the main sport in Ireland as a form of football. It was definitely had a head start on soccer. And we already see in Limerick it had the potential to bridge class divides. It had the potential to expand. And that may have happened, but obviously it didn't.
What's the relationship between soccer and rugby then? Because the kind of idea that is, insofar as people do think about it, the kind of idea that you get is that soccer was an urban working class game in Ireland and rugby was more diffuse. Was that actually the case? Was it, did rugby clash with soccer over players in the same way that it did with Gaelic games?
Again, not really, because soccer was slow to take root in Ireland. I mean, it arrived in Belfast first, but you're into the 1880s before it has any meaningful presence in any of the other cities. It's well behind the curve at that point. Where it does have appeal is among the working classes in Cork City, in Limerick City to some degree, and in Dublin. But again, you're largely looking at two separate constituencies. So rugby had its constituency, Gaelic games had its constituency, and soccer had its constituency as well. So the type of indiscriminate swapping of codes that you have at a certain point in England wasn't replicated in Ireland. There's no case of there's no clear case of a high profile rugby club switching to soccer. There are some one or two cases of it happening at a very local, scattered level in provincial towns, but not to any high profile clubs.
One of the other things that's kind of related to the social basis of rugby in Ireland is the importance that schools, secondary schools have, and particularly the elite secondary schools. And I think that's something from outside of Ireland, that's not especially clear. Whereas when you're actually in Ireland, then in Ulster, it's you know, the schools competition is a major event in the middle-class sporting calendar, and even more so in Dublin. Can you talk a bit about how that emerged and the actual strength of that? Because, as I say, I mean, you look at, you know, Dublin schools matches, you know, there's thousands of people there. They're almost like club matches in themselves.
They are, and a lot of the success that Leinster rugby enjoys these days is down to that fact. You hear commentators today saying that, well, Leinster have like 12 or 13 mini academies when you look at the schools that compete in their senior competition. But again, this is largely a product of the emerging Catholic middle classes in the second half of the 19th century and the demand that there was for elite education. And in that context, you see a whole load of fee-paying Catholic schools being set up in urban areas. And when it came to embracing sport, a lot of them made their decisions as to what their sport was going to be in the late 1870s and early 1880s. Most of them embraced rugby. And Gaelic games didn't really have a meaningful presence in schools until the early 20th century. So as a result of that, and when competitions are set up, a culture of schools rugby becomes embedded. And in Leinster and Munster, if you look at the schools' cups, they've been absolutely dominated from the start by elite Catholic schools. You could count on one hand the amount of times, even at the close of the 19th century, that Protestant schools actually got a look in. Now it's different in Ulster, obviously, because the game is uniformly Protestant. But the real significance of this was what it did to the demographic profile of Irish rugby in general. And I'm specifically talking about religion. So down to the early 1870s, even the late 1870s, I would say, the great majority of Irish rugby players and administrators in what became the Free State in the 26 counties outside of Ulster were Protestant. But what happens when Catholic schools embrace rugby is that you have a whole load of alumni fishing around for rugby clubs once they finish and, you know, into adulthood. And eventually the playing base of clubs that had faultlessly Protestant origins becomes mixed. And this is one of the interesting things, because for the ex-schoolboys of an elite Catholic school like Blackrock in Dublin, or like CBC, some Christian Brothers College in Cork, or Presentation Brothers College in Cork, it was an entirely feasible option for them to set up a senior old boys club and maintain the Catholic profile of that club. But it never happened. The players tended towards already established clubs, and most of those clubs were Protestant in background. So what you eventually have is religious mixing within these institutions, which I think is quite interesting.
Leaping massively ahead now, it strikes me, and I know we've spoke about this before, but it strikes me that in a lot of ways the social profile of Irish elite Irish rugby hasn't really changed over the last 100-odd years. That it's still, if you look where it was strong before World War One, it's strong in exactly those same places today. Is that, do you think that's true?
If you look at the pathways into elite rugby, it hasn't changed a great deal. From the 1920s onwards, the game hugely expanded into provincial towns of all sizes. So you almost have a separate culture of what's now amateur provincial town rugby in Ireland, to the degree that in Leinster, for decades, there's been a very successful provincial towns cup. So it's almost as if you've a separate culture of rugby. But in terms of pathways into elite rugby, and in terms of its appeal in cities, I don't think it's changed a great deal at all. And if you look at the selection of the international team, you still see the same handful of schools where players are recruited from. So that structure that developed in the late 19th century has proved to be extremely durable.
Yeah, and I suspect that's also the case for other sports, not just in Ireland, but all the other football codes, not just in Ireland, but around the world as well. I think what was established before 1914, it was kind of frozen by what happened in the war. And it just expanded on those the bases that it is established before the war.
And its longevity makes itself perpetuating because people, these clubs, you know, to borrow something from sociology, that they build up huge stores of social and cultural capital. They become permanent institutions and prestigious institutions. And I think that to some degree explains a sort of religious mixing I was talking about a few moments ago. If you take Cork, for example, the Cork Constitution Rugby Club. Now, the Cork Constitution was a unionist newspaper and a bellicosely unionist newspaper, and the staff of the Cork Constitution set up a rugby club, which was obviously unionist and Protestant in its outlook. But it took on sort of a civic significance as a club, and eventually the schoolboys leaving the elite Catholic schools tended to play for Cork Constitution because ultimately it was a reservoir of social and cultural capital that they wanted to tap into. You know, in terms of professional and business advancement, it was advantageous to join that club rather than trying to set up your own old boys club. So, as I said, it had a civic function. If you look at who the patrons of the club were, you had members of the Protestant ascendancy, which was, I mean, there was no Protestant ascendancy soon afterwards, but there still was elements of it then. But you had local high-profile nationalist politicians as well. So I think the idea of social and cultural capital and the prestige that institutions can garner, specifically in the context of a city like Cork with a population of around 70 or 80,000, no bigger than a northern town like St. Helens, for example, institutions can almost take on a sort of a systemic civic importance. And I think sport played into that quite well. And I think it bridged divides like religion to some degree.
Yeah, and I think, it points to the fact that how quickly the activities of sports clubs come to be seen as traditional. It's like, no sooner have they been established than 10 years later people are talking about, this has always been our tradition, and it's very difficult to change that because people obviously value tradition. So that's quite interesting. The other thing I was going to ask, coming off from what you just said, is given the game's deep roots amongst the Irish middle classes, both Catholic and Protestant, what is the extent of working class participation? I mean, what's the I don't know whether you have figures in terms of the percentage of players in the national team who come from a traditional manual working class background.
Very few. I don't have precise figures, but fittingly enough, if you look at, I've done some research on internationals between 1875 when Ireland played their first international down to 1914. And any player that could be considered working class came from Limerick, ultimately. So you had famous instances of Paddy Healy, a butcher from Limerick who was selected in the late 19th century. And there was a plumber and a postman from Limerick, even though that's a pretty respectable clerical job in some instances. But it was uniformly middle class. And with a real tendency towards the professions rather than business as well. Slightly more businessmen in the Ulster context, which makes sense because Ulster was a far more industrialised city than either Dublin or Cork was. But there was very, very little working class involvement, very little. The idea of somebody from a manual labouring background, there's no examples in those early decades of somebody from that kind of background actually making it onto the international team. But having said that, in Limerick, there was widespread working class involvement in the game. Those inter-parish junior rivalries that were nurtured through Sunday rugby gave the game mass appeal. So the game did become associated with the working classes there, with skilled and unskilled labourers, fishermen and so on. It really, really garnered a strong presence there. And one example I can give is in 1928, when a rugby club in Limerick called Young Munster, they won a competition called the Bateman Cup, which is essentially an All-Ireland competition. And if you look at the demographic profile of the players involved there, it was mainly manual labourers and people in semi-skilled jobs. So in Limerick, it had this working class presence. But you have to remember, Limerick was almost a separate theatre of operations when it came to Irish rugby. So in the 1920s and 1930s, the IRFU decided that they'd ban Sunday rugby because they thought it was a new they gave the impression, at least, that they thought it was a new practice. It had been going on in Limerick for 34 years at that point, for 34, 44 years, depending on when you talk about when they were trying to stamp it out. And it was as if they didn't know what was going on in Limerick. The culture was so self-contained in Limerick. And Gary Owen, for a lot of that time, had managed it and nurtured it quite carefully. So it's as if they didn't know what was going on in Limerick, or else they turned a tactical blind eye to it because they wanted to keep the game healthy there.
Moving on a bit, when Ireland was partitioned in 1921, was there ever any move to have two separate national teams? Because obviously that's the great peculiarity of Irish rugby today, that probably alone in any major sport, it's two nation states provide the same team. How did Irish rugby withstand the pressures of partition?
Well, I mean, for a start, when partition actually occurred, if you look at the demographic profile of those who ran the game, there's no compelling reason for them to split because they broadly had the same set of beliefs. I can only guess as to what their political beliefs were, but if you look at their social, religious and demographic profile, they were all likely to have been unionists. And you have to remember, by 1921, they'd already been the one institution for four decades. So they had a fairly firm and permanent structure in place. And it would have caused quite a lot of trouble to actually rupture that on the basis of what had happened in terms of partition. If you look at the institution of the IRFU itself, it immediately decided that it would ignore partition and not recognise it, because I suspect they wanted to maintain the unity of the IRFU, and the people involved greatly regretted partition. Ultimately, these were people who considered themselves Irish with a strong British inflection, and it was a matter of great regret, especially for the Southern Protestants, who to some degree felt they were now cut adrift in a Catholic state, that this rupture had actually happened. And just to give an example, in the 1920s, a club from Cavan, as you know, is in just on the Republic side of the border between North and South, but it is in Ulster, so it should be in the Ulster branch of the IRFU. A club from Cavan tried to affiliate to the IRFU, and they wrote to the IRFU saying, well, you know, now that partition has occurred, we think it would be appropriate for us to affiliate to the Leinster branch. And the IRFU wrote back very quickly and said, we don't recognise partition, so you will affiliate to the Ulster branch, or you'll affiliate to no branch. So that I'm paraphrasing there, but that was the general tone of the letter. And there seems to have been a very concerted effort to maintain unity and not to allow the constitutional change to affect the unity of Irish rugby, the unity of the Irish rugby international team and the Irish rugby football union at that point. And their main strategy for doing that was to ignore politics as best they could, to try and eliminate all mention of political issues when it came to rugby. So there was a real concerted effort to do that, to such an extent that There was numerous rows about anthems and flags and so on in the 1930s, for example.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because although there was unity at that level, it didn't mean to say there were not disputes over the symbolism of the two nations.
Well, so in 1932, for example, and it had been the IRFU's practice to fly sort of a composite flag at international fixtures in Dublin, so a green flag with the emblems of the various provinces on it, which remains the official flag of the IRFU to this day. So it was their policy to fly that, but not to fly the Irish tricolour. This caused a bit of a sensation in the press, and eventually the Minister for Foreign Affairs in Dublin wrote to the IRFU and basically ordered them to fly the tricolour, and they immediately relented and did it out of respect to the government. So there was all these kind of issues around flags and symbolism, but at the institutional level, and if you think about the way it's structured, so each year the IRFU elected a president, and once that president left office, they became part of the IRFU council. So by the time partition occurred, you probably had a couple of dozen, maybe not that many, maybe a dozen and a half presidents who were still alive who formed a council at that point and who had a long, long memory of Irish rugby being united. So it was a great deal more hassle to try and divide the country into two separate rugby teams than it was to stay together. They just had a tradition of being the one. The IRFU was at that stage an institution of four decades standing, and they basically left all politics aside and wanted to continue as united as possible.
And then in the 1950s, wasn't there a dispute over the singing of the national anthems?
Yeah, there was a dispute at Ravenhill, and it was the last fixture played at Ravenhill until, I think it was 2007 maybe, I don't know the precise date. So there was a dispute involving some of the Southern players, so some of the non-Ulster players selected for the Irish team. Now, the personalities involved remain obscure. So who did what and when, we don't know. But we do know that the Southern players, as a block, decided that they wouldn't go onto the field until the British national anthem had been played. The habit prior to then in Belfast, or the tradition prior to then in Belfast on an international day, was that the British national anthem would be played for the Irish team out of respect for the fact that Belfast was sovereign British territory, obviously, and that the Ulster players in the Irish team were British. But some one or two of the players had a great deal of trouble with this. It clashed with their political viewpoints, and they managed to convince the rest of the Southern players that, you know, let's leave the rest of the players out. They can stand for the national anthem. The Ulster players can do that, and then we'll join them. And there was very fretful and furtive negotiations that happened, and eventually the Southern players were convinced that to go out onto the field and to stand for the British national anthem. And the evidence we have is that the Ulster players knew nothing about this protest, but had it gone ahead, that could have caused a rupture at that point. It would have been a serious, serious scandal, and it would have been a sensation.
Just to, because we're running out of time, just to bring forward to the present day, obviously Ireland and the provinces have been pretty successful since professionalism came to rugby union 25 years ago. To what extent is that based on, I mean, people say, oh, well, it was initially due to the, you know, economic vibrancy of Ireland in the early 2000s and the Celtic Tiger and all this and the other. But from what you've been saying, it sounds like Irish rugby, because of its traditional structures, was actually very well positioned to welcome professionalism in a way that most other countries weren't. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah. Well, it's worked out that way. Looking back at it retrospectively, it seems to have worked out that way. But I do think the provincial structure, and you have to remember Munster, Leinster, Connacht and Ulster, they all had provincial teams. So every year, the Ulster, Leinster, Munster and Connacht team would take part in an interprovincial series. And for many decades, that was the basis upon which the international team would be selected. Now, these teams weren't particularly popular. The interprovincial series never attracted any great crowds. People only went to watch Munster and Leinster when they played against touring opposition, New Zealand or Australia or whoever else. But what it did offer, Irish rugby, club rugby, was way too small to accommodate. any kind of a professional game. What it did offer was a structure that professionalism could be grafted onto. Now, they had a fair amount of luck as well. So when the game went professional and when the provincial teams became professional from 1997 onwards, it just so happened that Munster Rugby was particularly strong at that point. The cycle of luck that brings teams and areas a certain glut of top-class players very conveniently landed on Munster's lap at that point. So a combination of the game going professional, a new European Cup competition, and this Munster team being particularly good gave the game sort of a profile it hadn't had previously in Ireland. And I think the Celtic Tiger contributed insofar as it gave people enough disposable income to go and watch that team regularly, to follow them on their various away trips around Europe. And eventually, as you said earlier, people's memories become kind of distorted and they began to imagine that this was the way it always was. And Munster had this amazing tradition, which they really didn't at all. And Leinster and Ulster were well placed anyway, because they had a really, really steady supply of players coming in from the schools. As I said, in Leinster, that Leinster Schools Cup and the colour and the rivalries that emerged from that, on a very practical level, is a really, really good pathway, the development pathway for young elite rugby players. So the provincial system worked well in that way, that there were these pre-existing teams were there and they were easily able to build up their fan bases. They did technically have a long tradition stretching back to the 1870s, but their tradition of actually being popular emerged in the professional era. It wasn't like Wales, who had to sort of artificially put together these regional teams. There was a Munster team that wore red. There was a Leinster team that wore blue going back more than 100 years. So that tradition was there. And as well as that, the Irish Rugby Football Union took a hugely interventionist role in the management of the professional game. So they essentially run these provincial teams. They remain branches of the IRFU. So you have the central governing body controls the entire professional game. And as a result of that, has a very, very clear influence over who they recruit in certain positions, especially around foreign recruitment. They've got very clear control over that. And they have control to a degree as to how often the international players play for their provinces. So the playing load of the players is managed very carefully as a result. And it is a good recipe for success, but it is a very centralised system.
On that note, as an example of how rugby union's traditions can actually benefit it in the professional area, which is kind of goes against conventional thinking, I'll draw it to a close. Thanks very much, Liam. That was absolutely fascinating. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my name is at Collins Tony, as I'm sure you're aware. Liam, are you on Twitter? I don't think you're on Twitter, are you?
Sort of. I don't really tweet.
But I will put a link to university homepage on the show notes to this episode. And just a reminder out there, if you want to wade deeper into the depths of the history of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at the Rugby Reloaded website at rugbyreloaded.com, where you can listen to the previous 101 episodes of this podcast and check out the show notes for this episode, which will include links to Liam's works. So until next week, thanks for listening.